CataractCoach.com, podcast number 33 with Dr. Guy Kazarian, developing the subspecialty of refractive surgery. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today we have Guy Kazarian, who's done so much in ophthalmology in so many different ways. In fact, even on this call, I was surprised to see he has an AI robot following him around to summarize his video calls, his conferences, etc. Amazing things. We want to talk about his new endeavor, which is the World College for Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences. We'll get into that, but also his path in ophthalmology, which has been very unusual, but incredibly successful. Guy, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks, Uday. It's good to be with you. And of course, your success is everywhere. You know, we have our fellows around the world, 25 of them now, and all of them watch your podcast and your YouTube about cataract surgery and cataract coach. They cite it all the time. So you're contributing so much. It's great to be with you.
Oh, thank you. It is a really fun project, obviously, to be involved with the teaching of the next generation. And you're doing that in a big way in a field that, gosh, a couple decades ago wasn't even recognized as a field, refractive surgery. Tell me about that.
Well, and you know, it's, as you know, you've been part of the evolution of it. We've had a series of technologies that have come along, starting with, let's say, radiokeratotomy in the 80s and went on to become excimer lasers, and now all these advanced lenses that we have and more advanced lasers in all of our imaging and diagnostics. It's allowed us to actually do something which motivated me to want to go into ophthalmology, and that was to actually help people see better. You know, when we look at the way that most of our efforts are spent, most of our resources are spent, they're treating a very important but very small part of what causes visual impairment in the world. And those are things like, you know, glaucoma and even cataracts, but corneal diseases, retinal diseases. If you take the numbers at face value, which has been done by the Lancet Commission on Global Health and Ophthalmology and other groups, the WHO has done some work on this, the Gates Foundation, different people have really looked at this. 89% or so of visual impairment in the world is caused by untreated refractive errors.
Wow. So if you get 100% of all, let's say, visual impairment issues, like 11% are cataract, retina, glaucoma, cornea, all that combined, and 89%.
Well, the cataract, I should have been more specific. Cataract would be part of the 89%. So cataract's about 20% of that, and about 80% of that is untreated refractive errors, including older people with presbyopia who just can't work anymore because they can't see and don't have glasses. Sure. It's hard to believe this where we live in the developed world and with all the resources we have. But, you know, if you've been to Africa, if you've been to these places that sub-Saharan Africa and where I spend a fair amount of time, it's appalling to see the poverty. And although the WHO with the Vision 2020 project has tried valiantly for decades to bring glasses to the world, we actually have more people and more higher percentage of people with visual impairment from refractive error than we had when they started that multi-billion-dollar project.
Wow. I mean, good point. I went to Tonga in the middle of the South Pacific on a cherry surgery vision trip, a country that essentially has no ophthalmologists, no surgical ophthalmologists. And we did a lot of cataract surgeries, did a lot of other diseases. But we passed out 1,000 pairs of presbyopic readers. Because the incidence of plano presbyopia with no reading glasses, like you said, they absolutely are not functional up close.
Well, good for you for going to Tonga. You know, all of us should be doing something with this, whether it's teaching or hosting ophthalmologists or, you know, new ophthalmologists from other countries and our practices, or donating funds, or going ourselves. We should all be doing something. The disparity of what we have compared to what's needed around the world is just shocking. And, yeah. You know, it's an interesting thing. I was in a business, you know, I did my MBA some years ago, and the frameworks in business school are so different than what we're used to in medicine. And one of the frameworks was this idea of differentiation. And if you have, let's say you have a room of 100 ophthalmologists, or a city with 1,000 ophthalmologists, and one of those ophthalmologists is taken out, the ophthalmologist and their family will be sad, but the rest of the community will be just fine because there's redundancy and there was nothing differentiating about that person. When you take an ophthalmologist like you and go to Tonga and you're the only surgical ophthalmologist on the island, your impact is unbelievable. Right. And so this idea of looking at what we can do, where we can offer it, how we can do this is so powerful. And I think that's really one of the motivations I've had. I've always been interested, even as a medical student and then as a resident, I was doing some third world, you know, being a Caribbean eye care. And I was just appalled that in the shadow of America, we have such terrible, terrible eye care and still do, frankly, in many of those islands. So it's been very motivating. And I can tell you more than anything else in my career, you know, going on one of these outreaches with Himalayan Cataract Project under Jeff Tabin and Matt Oliver, and going on one of these projects in Ethiopia or Ghana, or now we're going to Rwanda in February, going to these places and then having four surgeons in the course of a week give sight back to 2,000 people.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's just absolutely, and you're taking the patches off the next day and you can't help but be emotional because it is emotional. And they're saying, oh my, and they're touching the faces of their grandchildren and saying, oh, you must be so-and-so, because they're now putting the face together. Yeah. Taking, we had one girl that just moved all of us. She was an 18-year-old. She'd been blind since she was about 10. We tried to figure out, we're not sure what it was that she had, so some kind of viral disease, but gave her dense cataracts in both eyes. Took out her cataracts, and Matt Oliver, who's such a beautiful man, and he took her photograph with his iPhone, and he showed her her picture, and it was the first time this young, beautiful girl had ever seen her own face.
Wow. That's amazing.
It doesn't get any better than that. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, I know. I've done a lot of these charity trips, too, as well, and one thing I realized, other countries don't have seeing-eye dogs. They have seeing-eye children.
Yes.
So the grandmother gets this youngest grandchild who holds one end of a stick, grandma holds the other. That poor kid has no life. His job is the seeing eyes for grandma.
It takes the child out of school. It takes the dignity away from the older person. I mean, it's for all of their daily activities, including showering and bathing and everything else. It's very humiliating for these people who are grown adults who have had a full life and then become blind. As Jeff Tabin says, you know, their hair turns white, their eyes turn white, and they die. Yeah. And what happens now is we make their eyes better and they don't die. We show them that they extend their lives by 6 years on average with a published publication that Jeff did in Lancet. So when we resight someone who has these dependencies, these people taking care of them, we can not only return these kids to a normal life, let them go to school, but 2.5 people are returned to productivity for plus the person that is resighted, for every person that's resighted.
Wow.
So the economic impact of this, the society impact, the family impact, the community impact is huge.
Have you integrated some of this charity type trips into World College? And tell us more about the World College.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. And I think there's a couple of frameworks here that are important. And one is that, why is refractive surgery different? And why do we have to be a separate specialty, not a subspecialty, but a separate specialty from ophthalmology? Well, think about what we do. We focus on performance. We focus on giving people the best vision they've ever had. So as opposed to stopping loss, we're providing gain. You know, in ophthalmology, we typically try to stop loss. We try to prevent people from going blind with glaucoma or retinal disease or whatever. So that's on a you know, playing not to lose. But with refractive surgery, we play to win. We play to give people better vision, better performance than they've ever had. It's typically paid for in a different way. It's not a reimbursed environment. It's done with cash pay oftentimes. And so the whole psychology, the whole framework is different in refractive surgery than it is in ophthalmology. And the metaphor I use is plastic surgery had to be separate from general surgery. It's a whole different thing. So refractive surgery has to be different than ophthalmology. We have to be ophthalmologists first. You have to be a surgeon to be a plastic surgeon. But it's different in its whole focus and framework, and therefore we had to be a separate specialty.
So different than, let's say, cornea, retina, peds, oculoplastics even, just a completely separate arm. So not a subspecialty, but rather a distinct specialty.
A totally distinct specialty. And what does that require? It requires standards.
Sure.
It requires standards, because you can't have a specialty without standards. That means educational standards. That means testing, certification standards. That means even equipment and procedural standards and standards of care. And all of this has to be put into some kind of a framework that allows for people to recognize that this is a qualified refractive surgeon and qualified center, and allows people to follow a pathway to get them to that point where they become that person. And that is the entire purpose of the World College of Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences. It is basically to establish standards, provide frameworks where people can come together and work together and say, this is where we want to go with the specialty. And here's the metrics that we'll use to judge whether or not we're doing it well.
Wow. So that, I like that. So full encompassed program. So essentially, I guess, starting with a fellowship, therefore, after an ophthalmology residency, let's say a refractive surgery approved type of fellowship.
So we're working now on, and Dan Reinstein is the head of the standards and curriculum section. And these are large sections with many people involved. But this standards and curriculum section is saying in a residency program, for example, you know, the AUPO, which focuses on Americans, the American university professors, the AUPO focuses on the standards for American residency training. And they require you to either observe or see five refractive procedures, among which is an LRI. Okay, that's the requirement in the US. So we're working on saying, well, if you want to become accredited as a residency program that also is teaching refractive surgery, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And it's going to be actually doing both laser, you know, both corneal and lens refractive surgery. When it comes to fellowship programs, there's many great fellowship programs out there. And I'll talk about the RSA fellowship program in a minute because it's a little bit different. But there's really no standardized curriculum. In fact, we looked at this across the specialties and we didn't see any standardized curricula anywhere. So typically they're apprentice programs where you follow the senior mentor around for a year and you learn what you can through being on the job. Maybe you do a research project. But we formed a standardized curriculum that for the RSA fellowship program, and we intend to take elements of that for that work, but just hand it over to the college and say, here's what we think a standardized curriculum should look like. Here's what a fellowship should look like. How many cases, how many, you know, what kind of literature are being provided, what kind of presentation requirements are there, what kind of surgical logs have to be demonstrated, different kind of elements of it. That then will go and credit all these programs that are great programs out there that we can then say, yeah, you're an accredited fellowship program. Why is that important? Because then after they do that, then they can sit for the exam and become a fellow of the World College of Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences. So standards are critically important. The other aspect of what we want to do is position the World College, including visual sciences, and that's a really important distinction, including visual sciences, to provide a common meeting ground for the entire industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big statement. So we've taken a few examples. There's two examples that I think are very, very germane. One is aviation, which in the 1960s had maybe 18 billion passenger miles in the US, which sounds like a lot, but one airplane could do a couple million miles by flying 300 people across the country. It's not that many miles. And there were about 600 to 700 to 800 deaths every year from commercial plane crashes. And the entire industry got together and they said, you know, we can't keep this up. We have to become about safety. So that went to airports, air traffic control, airplane manufacturer, pilot training, all the things that go into making aviation work. It said, here's our standards. And now they do over a trillion passenger miles in the US every year. And people get on the plane and they don't even think about it. I mean, I watch when I'm taking off in a plane, people don't even look up from their reading. They're going to this metal tube going, you know, 200 miles an hour before they lift off, and they're flying in a negative pressure atmosphere with minus 50 degrees outside, and they don't even look up from their reading because they're that confident in the safety of the aviation industry. And
look at the growth, you said, was from 18 billion to 2 trillion, so like 100x growth.
Exactly. And so with that, we need to take that model and focus on safety. Safety begins with standards. So that requires cooperation and collaboration among everyone, beginning with the scientists. You know, we more than most fields in medicine, work so closely with our developers, with our innovators, our scientists, our just, you know, all the people that are involved in technology and innovation. And yet we've not ever provided them with a common place to come together and work together and collaborate and say what we're going to do next. Now, the other example that we use is the consumer electronics industry. So I don't know if you've ever been to the CES show in Las Vegas.
Big show.
Yeah, I've been going every year for the last 20 years, and we bring out one of our software crews over there, and that's their big, you know, for them, that's a really great time. So we go to this conference, and I was just amazed, not at the contents of the conference, but at the structure and what they do, the format of the conference. So they bring everyone together. They bring the developers together, with some of the users together, with the companies together, with the distributors together, and they bring them all together and they say, hey, you know what? Here's the standards of how we're going to do things. And actually, here's what we're going to do next. So think about this. We all use cell phones and we can travel around and change networks all the time, right? I go to Europe and my phone still works. I go to Africa, my phone still works, right? And here I am in America. How did that happen? That was not by accident. They could have all developed their own standards, but yeah, they got together and they said, here's our standards. My topographer can't talk to my microscope unless it happens to come from the same company that locks it into the same platform. I can't change data between five different topographers to evaluate whether they're consistent and looking at OCTs and looking at everything. I can't do it because we don't have standards. And we have to develop those standards if we're going to grow. Look at what's happened with consumer electronics. They went from brick cell phones and no computers in my, or both of our lifetimes, right? I mean, we were in high school, computer was a big deal. And to we're talking to each other now virtually as if we're both in the same room. And that's happened through a series of coordinated efforts in that industry to say, we're going to first develop smaller phones and miniaturized circuitry. We're going to develop better circuit boards. We're going to develop the internet. We're going to develop 3G, 4G, 5G, edge computer, Internet of Things. They've gone through this whole series of developments, and they weren't doing it haphazardly. They did it as an industry with standards. It said, then they learned the lesson from Betamax and VHFs. I don't know if many of you remember that. But there used to be two standards for videotape, and they weren't compatible. And the better one actually lost because they weren't marketed as well. That was Betamax. And so VHS prevailed. They learned that lesson after that. They said, you know, this is nonsense. We have to have a common standard. We in refractive surgery have to have a common standard so that we can get all of our people, to all of our innovators, to work on the same platforms and allow for interchange of data. Digital medicine is going to be the thing that allows us to solve vision impairment and refractive errors in the world. It's going to be through automation, AI, standards, being able to communicate data, being able to have you lean over the shoulder of someone operating in Ethiopia and say, well, let's do this next. And hey, let me coach you as if they were sitting next to you in your own office. That's how we're going to make this happen.
But it has to be, as you pointed out, industry-wide. So we can't work in vacuums. We all have to kind of have the same industry-wide standards. That's the key.
And I know how you have the same view of what the industry is that I do. People often think of we have the doctors and we have the industry, and that's not true. We're all in the industry. The industry couldn't exist without the doctors. The industry couldn't exist without the patients, or in refractive surgery, without the optometrists, without the technicians, without the distributors, without the manufacturers. All together, we are the industry. Aviation came together through a UN-established organization for the international airline corporations, and they formed standards. And by getting together, they were able to provide a common meeting ground for people to create all these other things, all these standards. That's where we think the World College will be. And what's cool about the IACO is they don't compete with anybody. They don't make airplanes. They don't fly people around. They don't build airports. They don't train pilots. They don't do anything other than say, let's all agree on standards. And that's what the World College of Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences is going to be. So we want to be supportive of the societies. We want to be supportive of the companies. We want to be supportive of the doctors and all of the people, all the industry players. We want to be a common meeting ground for them, and a common communication platform for them, so they can come together without anti-competitive practices and all the things that prevent manufacturers from working together today around standards, come together around standards. And that's where we are positioning the World College. So it's really a standard organization, which is about trying to create an organized way for us to move forward and address the number one cause of visual impairment in the world, which is refractive errors.
But I think you bring up a very important point that it has to be a team, much like a baseball team or a soccer or football team. You can't just have one player win the game. No. You have to have a complete team, and everyone's got a bit of a different role. And while we've got the surgeon role, we still need all the other roles as well. Whether it's industry people, obviously the patients are probably the most important of all. We need optometrists or technicians or our staff members. Mm-hmm. It's a whole team.
Yeah, I don't think any of us could operate doing LASIK without a laser.
Right. Basically,
We couldn't do cataract surgery without IOLs.
Right.
Right. We need to work together on this. And so far, we've done a pretty good job in collaborating with manufacturers on saying, hey, I need this new gizmo, make it for me. And they would make it for us, right? We've done that for years. All I'm saying is that let's organize this around standards so that we can have common data transfer, common, you know, we did this great thing 12, 13 years ago with George Waring III, God bless him, Jack Holliday, Dan Reinstein, FDA. We got together, we wrote a couple of papers, and they came out with these 9 graphs that we use to compare data in refractive surgery that are now made the way all the journals recommend recognize them, they all require them. And those 9 graphs gave us a standard way to look at outcomes. If I'm reporting my 2020 rates and you're reporting your 2015 rates, we have no way for us to say who's doing a better job, right? So we have to have these common things. It seems so obvious when you look at it in that perspective, right? And yet we don't have it. We have it for that. We have it for outcomes recordings, but we don't have it for things as simple as how do we make a height map in a topography? How do we measure the thickness of the cornea with OCT? Where do we draw the line? Do we draw on this side of the dark line or that side of the dark line? And all these different things are just crazy. So it's time. We come into maturity. We've been around for about 30 years with refractive surgery since the lasers came out. It's time for us to now outgrow adolescence, enter adulthood, and bring this field forward. And so many people depend on us for it.
Right. But I think you make up a good point with the Betamax versus VHS. So for those who don't know, before you had streaming video, you had DVDs. Before DVDs, you actually had magnetic tape, which you used recorded video on in low definition, 640 by 480. And the two competing ones were VHS, which was kind of everyone, and Sony, which was Betamax, and they were not compatible. But yeah, the problem was developing both in parallel. What a lot of wasted effort. We should have been all working on the same standards. So I think that's important. We're seeing that now in the digital operating room, right? We can start to see that we're all moving towards that digital OR. And you've got Alcon competing with Zeiss. Now you have some other players coming out. B&L's trying to release a digital scope in collaboration with Heidelberg. You've got other partners too. We all need to do it the same way, though, so that I don't have to have only one company's ecosystem. I can have this topographer, this biometer, this microscope, and have them all talk to each other.
And why does this have to be led by doctors? You know, you and I, Uday, I don't know how many decades we've known each other, but it's been a long time.
20 years.
Yes. and you know, it's because we make a lifelong commitment to our field. And we're the only ones who do. There's a few people I know in the manufacturing side that have been here for my whole career, but very few. Most of them, they might be in ophthalmology this year and cardiology next year and oncology the year after that. And then maybe they might go into private equity. You never know, but they're business people, and for them that's their domain. For us, we're committed to ophthalmology, we're committed to refractive surgery, and we are for our whole career. So the longitudinal players are the doctors. We're the ones with the long-term perspectives, we're the ones with the commitment. So it has to be led by doctors, but the World College is intentionally inclusive. So, you know, we're in like over 60 countries in terms of having fellows. We have recognized fellows from over 60 countries. We have a board which is made up of doctors and corporate seats. So we have three seats for the corporations. We have we want them to be at the table. We have the scientists, which are also very involved in all aspects of what we're doing. It's intentionally inclusive, but the leadership and the long-term perspective has to come from the doctors because we're the only ones who are here for the long term.
Yeah, there's nowhere else I can go with my skill set. I've got to stay in surgical ophthalmology.
We're committed.
No, so, well, you bring a lot of important things from your business background, because for those who don't know, Guy also has an MBA that he earned, but he also leads the whole physician CEO program, which we'll get into as well. But I like how you really bring some kind of business aspects into ophthalmology, which weren't so common before.
You know, when I was in medical school, and my family is in business, and I thought, well, you know, I'm a doctor. I'm so smart. I know so much, right?
And I said the same naive thing.
and I struggled. You know, I had a practice. It was okay. But, you know, I see people go from zero to, you know, billion-dollar organizations so quickly, and I wonder, well, they must know things I don't know. So I went and I did my MBA, and I was in my early 50s when I did it. It was, you know, several years ago. And the only perspective I have is that if I had had that training in my 30s, I would have had a very, very different life. The frameworks that you get in business school are so powerful, and they just allow you. They don't really teach you that much that's new. There's certain things like understanding accounting and things like that, sure, but it's mostly about reorganizing how you think, reorganizing your thoughts in what they call frameworks, taking things and making sense out of them, understanding what matters and what doesn't matter. And so for me, business school was the total pivot in my life. And since business school, that was when I began with some great people, Greg Parker, Lance Kugler, Luke Rebinich, Aaron Wade, others. We formed the Refractive Surgery Alliance because we recognized that the culture in refractive surgery was wrong. It was competitive. It was nasty. You still see this in some markets with, I invented LASIK, or I'm the best in the world, or, the guy down the street's a hack, or whatever. And you still see it. But for the most part, we have changed the culture. Refractive surgery is all about collaboration. And it's been around now for a decade and has been extremely successful in terms of changing the whole dialogue among refractive surgeons to work together to grow the field. You know, Uday, when 99% or so of the people in every country, but in America, are choosing glasses or contact lenses instead of having their eyes fixed, the competition is not the 1% of people who are fixing people's eyes. The competition is the 99% who are providing the glasses and contact lenses.
So why isn't it more accepted? Like, everyone that I know, certainly in my area of the woods, kids turn 10, 12, 13 years old, they get braces for the teeth. Their teeth are perfect. Even I got braces. But why is it that when they turn 22, they don't get refractive surgery and enjoy a life of great vision? Why?
Because people like to talk about cost. They like to talk about fear. And I think both of those things are symptoms of the root cause, which is simply lack of awareness. So we did that study a few years ago that we published on refractive surgeons and asking them, have you had refractive surgery? Have you done it on your immediate family, children, wives, husbands? And the answer was that over 2/3 of them had had refractive surgery themselves, and over 90% had done it on their family, immediate family, which for me reinforced my hypothesis, was that the barrier to refractive surgery is not money or fear, it is knowledge. Because the people who knew the most about refractive surgery are the most likely to have it. So
what? Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and to me, that was a profound insight. That was I tested that hypothesis with Greg Parkhurst, Rich Norden, and we wrote that paper, and it was very, very important to. And I think Jason Britton might have been on that paper as well. And it was very important to you can say I think it's this, I think it's that. If unless you test it, you don't really know. Get the data. So we got the data on that, and then we showed that it was that refractive surgeons were the most likely to have refractive surgery. And so that completely changed how I look at marketing and everything else. So we then said, okay, what are we going to do about that? So I have, in the Refractive Surgery Alliance, we encourage people to focus not on trying to sell a procedure, but to educate people. So when you pull the four-opter away, we used to say to tell the people, did you know you're a candidate for vision correction? Do you want to talk about it? We had someone, one of our RSA members, studied this formally. He had several optometry clinics. He had half of them asked the patients that question. The other half just kept doing what they were doing. The ones who weren't asking the question had about an 8% referral rate for people that were coming. And they were owned by the refractive surgeon. And they were supposed to be the referring patients. The ones who asked that question, the referral rates went up to over 60%.
Well, I was simply asking the question.
Simply that question, because people are afraid. And they often say, well, I saw that I can't have it because I have astigmatism. Which is hard. Right, yeah. They don't know. We assume they know. The business people call this the curse of expertise. It's so obvious to you that you think everyone else must know this, but they don't know this. So but now we've even changed that a little bit further. And we pull the four up and we say, well, you have several options to correct your vision. Let's talk about them all. You could have glasses, you could have contacts, and they go through the whole panoply of different procedures that they could have. And that's even more effective. So we have to change how we present things. We can't assume people know things. We can't assume they can't afford things. We can't assume they don't want things. We just have to assume they don't know. And we have to educate them.
And I can promise any prospective refractive surgery patient, the braces are far more expensive, at least here in Los Angeles, and it hurts a lot, whereas the refractive surgery doesn't hurt at all.
And they use it every waking minute. You've talked about this for years. I remember seeing one of your talks, 15 years ago, where you talked about going to the dentist and getting a crown for like $8,000 or something like that for a tooth. Whereas, you know, we correct people's vision and they can see 20, you know, for every waking moment. And in fact, people should look at everywakingminute.com. It's a non-branded website that we put up to try to address this education issue at everywakingminute.com. But the idea is that the World College can help also facilitate this. So we're beginning in 2024 a global education and awareness campaign. And it's going to be well funded by everyone participating. Doctors are going to help fund it. The manufacturer is going to help fund it. And we're going to use existing platforms that already exist that don't cost us anything, like your own practices, social media platform to put out the messages. We'll provide the assets, the graphics and all those things, and you'll be able to put them out with your branding. And you know, we've done this with the RSA in the past. It was very successful. We can look at themes that people just don't think about. We have to reposition refractive surgery as being a cosmetic procedure for rich people to play tennis at the country club on weekends, to being a functional procedure to let that guy pitch tar or climb on a roof, or the young person going to school, or someone learning to drive a truck, or become an athlete, or pursue their dreams. It is a functional procedure that couldn't be more functional than letting people see, right? And yet the image of refractive surgery is it's a bunch of, you know, rich people just having something done because they don't want to be bothered with glasses. No. It lets people engage in all kinds of occupational things that they couldn't do otherwise. That's why in 2005, the military, U.S. military, formed the WRESP program, the Warfighter Refractive Eye Surgery Program, which has done over 1 million soldiers now because they consider vision to be a condition for combat readiness. And of course it is, right? And this has now been copied all around the world in all militaries, but it's also been copied with first responders. So first responders now, police, I mean, I'm sure you've operated on hundreds of police. I mean,
these firefighters, you got it.
Exactly, and because it's practical, it's functioning, yet still people see it as being some kind of a cosmetic thing. And now, you know, look at the older people. 1 in 4 people over the age of 65, documented by CMS, 1 in 3 people documented by NHS in England, will have a life-threatening fall every year after the age of 65. Every year, 1 in 3 or 1 in 4 people, 40% of those falls are attributed directly to multifocal glasses, bifocals, varifocals, whatever. Getting rid of those glasses can save over $14 billion a year in medical costs alone in the U.S. This is real numbers. This is real consequences. As you know, many times people fall, they break their hip, and it's kind of the beginning of the end for them. And we can extend their lives with this. We can give them quality of life. So our refractive cataract surgery is not a cosmetic procedure. And it's worth every single penny that people pay for it. And it's worth every bit of training that it takes, the kind of training that you support, to be good at it so that you can actually deliver that result. One of the things that, you know, is maybe a little politically incorrect to talk about, I think it's so paradoxical and incorrect that most of ophthalmology, and I can say that with confidence, most of ophthalmology looks down upon refractive surgery.
That's too bad.
And it's always been that. It's crazy, though. And there was some justifiable reason. There were some definite cowboys out there that did some bad things. But, you know, that's still the prevailing, you know, most of the residency programs are run by retina and glaucoma people, and that's why we don't have refractive surgery in the residency programs. So, you know, they just don't think it's a serious pursuit. And yet, it's so serious. In fact, with the Refractive Surgery Alliance, we've decided, and this is, we'll talk about this in just a second, to form this fellowship program. And we recognized that there was so much to teach in refractive surgery, we couldn't do it all in 1 year. So it's a 2-year program. Now, the first year of the fellowship, the second year, they're associates. They're not fellows anymore, but they're getting the surgical volume with supervision. But there is no room for error in refractive surgery. You cannot, you cannot take a 25-year-old and, I broke capsule on their, or, you know, I saw a case the other day in one of our journal clubs where was putting an ICL and they ripped the anterior capsule off. And,
oh, boy.
Yeah, I mean, we can't have that. We can't have that. Surgical precision is critical, far more in a refractive cataract procedure than it is in the, you know, typical cataract procedure, right?
Well, go back to the pilot analogy. You need to have that level of confidence.
Right. That's right. And that requires training, and it requires a different level of expertise. And so I think actually kind of like we look up I do anyway, I look up at plastic surgeons as being really superior surgeons. I mean, they're amazing. They go over the whole body. They have training that went on forever. They're amazing surgeons, very knowledgeable people. I look at refractive surgeons the same way, as being super trained, super skilled. And this requires that extra level of expertise. So, you know, it's time, Uday, it's time for us to have refractive surgery as a separate specialty. It's time for us to have standards. It's time for us to come into maturity and out of adolescence. It's time to come together and recognize, you know, that we have to stop focusing on strategies and tactics, and we need to get back to purpose. Because, you know, we train people, you train people, very important, critically important to what we do. Do a great cataract. You are the cataract coach, right? So you've invested so much in that, absolutely essential to what we're doing. But if we're only doing cataracts on Park Avenue, you know, millionaires, and we're ignoring cataract blindness around the world, we've lost sight of our purpose.
Right. Absolutely. It's why you need to do both. I think you can do it in your own practice or your own environment, but also, like you said, it's so critical to take a trip. If you're a young surgeon and you want to really ramp up your skills, you can do a charity surgery mission trip with the most difficult cases and the most rudimentary equipment. It will make you a much better surgeon. It's the reason I did it. I used to do a week or two long trip every year for 20 years until COVID. Every year.
And there's great people out there. There's great organizations that will support this. They know that you're learning. They'll teach you. They'll bring you through the whole process. They'll keep you safe. They'll keep the patient safe. They'll provide the resources and the infrastructure. Wonderful, wonderful groups that do this. I mean, Greg Parkhurst has a charity that goes down. The Hawaiian Eye Foundation does a lot of this work. The Himalayan Cataract Project, the ICO, all these different groups are doing wonderful, wonderful work around the world. And so look them up and get involved, because I can tell you that you know, I could buy you all the fancy bottles of wine and dinner in the world, but you take the patch off of someone who's been blind and you give them their sight back you see them the joy, and you see them see their family for the first time in years, and you see them gain their dignity back. It just, there's nothing better.
Yeah, I think I always say the white cataract to me is the biggest and best miracle in all of medicine. Someone who's literally blind in 5 minutes back to normal vision. That's like, it's an amazing thing. But I think it's important to get started young and get started early in your career. You bring up a very good point. 25 years ago when I was a resident, there was no LASIK being done by residents at all, period. I found one faculty member, believe it or not, my advisor, she was a glaucoma person, Ann Coleman at UCLA. And I said, Dr. Coleman, it's really important that we get to do some LASIK. LASIK's now starting to happen. It's like 1997. She went to bat. She went to bat for the residents. You know, she's a glaucoma person. And she convinced the department that residents have to do some LASIK. So I got to be lucky. The first resident ever at UCLA to do LASIK did four eyes back when I was a senior resident in like the late 90s. And you know what? Bless this woman. Now she's chairman of UCLA. And I couldn't be any happier. Just an incredible person. But yeah, you have to advocate for yourself. And even now, though, we have a program for 25 years, UCLA residents can do LASIK. And more than half don't even care to pursue it. They don't even learn it. Whereas I wanted to learn the retina case. Okay, teach me how to do a scleral buckle. I may never do it again. Show me how you do the orbitotomy. But it kind of was disheartening that even as of recently as like 2 years ago, more than half the residents said, nah, I know we can do LASIK. I don't want to. What?
Yeah. And, you know, I work with the UCLA residents. I work with all of them. They bring them through with DataLink, and we show them the software, and I talk to them about surgical planning and concepts of you know, what is a nomogram and how do you plan surgery and setting the target and all those different things. And that program has really been the vanguard. That and Iowa are the two programs that have really integrated refractive surgery into the residency program. But, you know, UCSF is starting to do more. Some of the other residencies are starting to do more. Down at University of Texas in Dallas, We work with them all the time as well. So there's discipline programs into doing it. And, you know, frankly, as a resident, if you're watching this, ask, just ask, say, hey, why don't we have refractive surgery? I want to do my refractive surgery. If you don't have it in your program, through the Refractive Surgery Alliance, we have centers all over the country, all over the world. And we have a policy in the Refractive Surgery Alliance, which is if any Refractive Surgery Alliance member asks to come visit your practice, the only answer is yes. So you could visit any practice and go and spend time during some of your elective times. And right. you could see these practices, even if it's not in your residency program, you have access to this. The Refractive Surgery Alliance has the residency series, the resident series for refractive surgery, which Uday's been part of. And we do those about once a month on a Tuesday. Refractivealliance.com has the schedule. And that's accessible to you. So you can access this. You can access this. And I would say that if you want to look at the future, I went forward 10 years, I went forward 20 years. What are the growth areas, growth opportunities in ophthalmology as an ophthalmologist? Number one, two and three are all refractive surgery.
For sure.
It's the demand is there, and now finally the technology is here, and the opportunity is just limitless.
Yeah, I think as a resident, just a couple little cases you do, or even if you're observing them, just gets you so excited that then, yeah, it sets you up to pursue an RSA fellowship and really devote your entire career to this field.
And so, you know, just to get involved and to understand it is critical. You know, the thing that is a barrier to entry that we have, Uday, that we've been trying to address for the last several years now. And of course, you know, Helen Wu from Tufts University,
sure.
and Radhika Rampatu is in London. Giovanni Taibbi, who's in Florida, and Brett Mueller, who's in Texas, they're the academic directors of the RSA fellowship program. And what they've done is they've created a formal curriculum, as we mentioned before, and it takes place on Saturdays. And so the fellows come and they spend typically about 3 hours doing lectures. We'll bring in top people from around the world, mm-hmm. and they will have these virtual lectures, present cases, do journal club, et cetera, and go through all the main topics of refractive surgery. And I have been amazed to see the impact of this program. These people come out after 2 years knowing more about refractive surgery. They know the history of it, they know the technology of it, they know everything about it. It's more than people who have been practicing for 20 years and just never did a fellowship. And what we did was we made it where any fellowship can become part of this. So if you have a corneal fellowship, you have a refractive fellowship, and you want to become part of this network, then you just simply join the network. And your fellow then gets exposure to all these resources and goes through the program. It is a 2-year program. So we want the center that's training the fellow to agree to keep them for a second year as an associate where they can build their surgical skills. And they still to participate in those conclaves, but they're a fellow for the first year. It's most about learning. And they're an associate for the second year. It's mostly about operating. And so it's working out. It's in its third year now. It's doing really well. And we got about 25 fellows this year from all over the world. We have,
wow.
We have like 4 in South Africa.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's very cool. Yeah. So
you mentioned a little bit early on about how you work with the residents in their nomogram development.
Yes.
Tell us about that, because you were obviously the pioneer here with excimer laser nomograms. How did you get into this, and what did we learn from all this? Because you are literally the leader in this.
Thank you. It's one of those things where serendipity plays a role. We just a quick recap, but when the lasers were approved for, they were approved for PRK, and they were just for spherical myopia, 0 to 7 diopters, and so they were very limited utility, and people were frustrated with that, and people didn't really like PRK very much. I had been to Colombia and watched Luis Ruiz operate. I had seen Barato in Milan. I had seen Plekaris in Greece doing LASIK. And we thought, well, that's a cool idea, you know, just make a flap. In fact, I was there when the very first hinged flap was made. I was there, Luis Ruiz made it, and was with Tom Abel, who was a refractive surgeon in Kentucky. And he said to Luis, we're watching him do, he was literally doing like 17 patients an hour. It was an incredible, so back in 1993. He would just sit there and the patient would reel in and reel out. It was amazing.
Wow.
It was amazing. But and Tom said, why don't you, instead of playing with that cap and trying to reposition it, why don't you just leave it attached on one side? And he did, and that was the first LASIK lab. So, but anyway.
Tommy Abel, my buddy, that's an amazing story.
It was great. So this thing, the lasers became approved finally in 1996 in the US, first by Summit and then by PhysX. And we wanted to do LASIK. We didn't want to do PRK. So Charles Casebear, who really is the one that brought refractive surgery to the modern era in the US with teaching, Charles Casebear said, let's form a study. I had just stopped practicing because I had some health issues. He said, Guy, why don't you run a study? So I wrote a protocol. I got 25 friends. They each contributed $5,000 to pay for admin expenses and give me a job. And we formed the CRS LASIK study, which is Casebear, Ruiz, and Slade. CRS LASIK study. And wow. And that, so we did this. And then about 6 weeks later, we had our second meeting in Minneapolis, the ISRS meeting with Dick Lindstrom. And we're up there and bam, bam, bam on the door. And we had these eight guys from the FDA, including Maurice Waxler and some others, and four of them had guns, and they were the police of the FDA. And, wow. And you must shut this down. You're breaking the law. You're doing a study on investigational study on people without FDA oversight. And then bang, bang, bang on the door, two sets of two attorneys walk in, two from Summit, two from PhysX, served us with papers and sued us for violating their patents and doing LASIK and not using the lasers for PRK because their patents didn't cover LASIK.
Oh.
So that was interesting. And then we had 63 doctors outside said, we want to be let in. We're going to sue you for restraint of trade because you're not letting us in the study. So Charles came. Yeah, wow. This was all at one time, all like within a 15-minute period. And so Charles Casebear, who's just a brilliant guy, said, this is an opportunity. And he went to the FDA and said, you actually have no authority here. We're doctors. We can do whatever we want. We bought these lasers. They're approved medical devices. I know the law. You know the law. You're just blustering. You should either leave or work with us. And they said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, we'd like to have you. We'll give you the data. We'll work with you. We'll let you have oversight. But you have to let us open the lasers up to do whatever they can do, including astigmatism and hyperopia. And they said, okay, but you have to then bring it for an FDA approval. We can't just oversee without leading toward a regulatory approval. He said, okay. So then he went to the lawyers and they said, look, you guys just spent $30 million getting your lasers approved. That was cheap then compared to today. And he said, we're going to do it for you for free. And we're going to get your lasers approved for LASIK. We'll sign over all the IP. We'll sign over the approvals. All we want is access to your FDA files and cooperation of the FDA. And they said, okay, not right there. It took about 2 months, but they said, okay. And then we went to the doctor and said, well, we now have lasers. We can open up your laser to do whatever you want to do as long as you provide data. And we wound up enrolling 312 doctors into the biggest FDA trial that's ever happened and the only FDA trial that was ever funded by the doctors. So we wound up, the doctors paid for that. It allowed us to afford to do the study. We flew all around the country, visited all 312 sites, and we did the FDA approval. So we start getting all this data in, right? Now all the data's coming in, and it doesn't make any sense. It was terrible. People would, some one person would program a -5 and they get -3. Next one would program a -5, they get -7. It was like, what's going on with this? And so I called one of my mentors, Jack Holliday, and I said, Jack, can you help me make sense of this data? So I would flew down to Houston every week for about 10 weeks in a row. And Jack and I would spend the weekend just looking at numbers. And we realized that, hey, we can nomogram this. We can mathematically model this. And that began the concept of modern nomograms. So that led to a software company, which has a big AI backend now. And it's a product that's distributed with some of the lasers. And it works really well. And that's been my lifeblood for the last, 30 years is nomograms. And it's allowed us to really improve outcomes to the point now where 55% of the people who use Datalink, which I think you use as well. 55% of the people who use Datalink have a 100% 20/20 rate for their myopes. I mean, enhancements are now unusual events. When we started out, every third patient was getting enhanced.
Wow, that's wild.
Yeah, so the UCLA residents, the UTMB residents, some of the other ones, whenever they're doing their refractive rotation, I volunteer to do a one-on-one with them for about an hour. I bring them through surgical planning concepts and nomogram concepts, and I get to meet this next generation. It's the best part of my week. So I get to meet this whole next generation of people, and they get to do better surgery.
That's fantastic. Yeah, you've always been a big advocate of education. Absolutely. From the 20 plus years I've known you. Now, that also extends into your physician CEO program. Tell us about that. I am so tempted. I need to sign up for this. Tell me more about it.
Thank you, Uday. So as I mentioned before, you know, business changes the way you think and look at the world. It's just, it changes everything. And sure. And just, under, you know, it's one thing to not understand business and be critical of it. It's another thing to actually understand business and make sense of why things are the way they are. Nothing's by chance. So I did my MBA and I thought, this is so valuable. And I went to the dean at the end. They do an exit interview, which is brilliant. I don't know why residency programs don't do exit interviews. Why don't we do exit interviews? You know, how can we be better? That was the question. That was the point of the exit interview with the dean of the business school. How can we do better? They asked this with humility for every graduate that they have. That's a brilliant idea. It's such a simple thing, right? And yet, so I said, well, you know, we had a class of 74 people. We had six doctors and two of them weren't practicing. If we had all the doctors get at least some business exposure, we wouldn't have a medical crisis in this country. We would be saving tons of money. We wouldn't allow insurance companies and hospitals to extort money from patients. We wouldn't allow the pharma companies to be charging 10 times for drugs in the U.S. than they do outside the U.S. because the doctors could do this. And she said, well, the doctors won't come. They're too busy, blah, blah, blah. We have an MD-MBA program. No one participates. I was like, look, we're supposed to be the marketing school at Kellogg, which it is, the marketing and team building school. Why don't we make a program they can come to? And she said, well, will you help to organize that? So I said, yeah, absolutely. So I did. I worked with their faculty, and we organized the program, which takes the essence of an MBA program. It gets rid of all the stuff which is irrelevant, although interesting, like international finance and investment banking. It takes some of that stuff out. So it takes the core curriculum of the MBA program, adds in a layer of leadership, which doesn't exist in the MBA program, because the MBA programs are about management. They're not about leadership. So it's about middle management. It's not about CEO leadership. And this is a physician CEO program. It's about being leadership. And the difference, of course, is managers are focused on metrics and getting the job done more efficiently and task-oriented kind of pursuits, whereas the CEO is about who are we, what's our culture, what's our brand, what do we do, what don't we do, how do we align with others, how do we create value. CEO is more about the purpose of the organization and making overseeing the managers, but it's not about, you know, doing the books. And so we put a lot of leadership into the program. Then we divided it into a time efficient format. So people come in on Saturday, they go home on Wednesday. It's a fire hose while you're there. It's pretty intense. But we do it over four modules, we call them, over the course of about 9 months. And it cycles every year. And then they come out with, during that whole time, they're working on their own business plan. Now that might be for a younger person, I'm going to build my first practice. That might be for someone in the middle, I'm going to grow my practice. That might be, I'm going to just start up and create a new widget. It might be for an older person, my succession plan. How am I going to bring someone else in to take over my practice? And so all great, interesting, you know, diversity of business, you know, goals that people come with when they design their business plans, but everyone leaves with their own real actionable go forward, what they're going to do next business plan.
Wow, that sounds amazing. How many doctors do you have in your class every year on average?
We try to keep it to between 30 and 35 so that we can provide it. It's a very highly individualized program. We've had as many as 45, but we realized that kind of diluted it, and it's not about being a factory, it's about quality. So we limit it now to between 30 and 35. And
you've been doing it for 10 years now?
Yeah, it's been since 2015 was the first year. Eight years. So, and we just finished a class. So, but it's been real, you know, some of the success stories are amazing by, you know, happenstance, not by design. Most of the participants are ophthalmologists just because that's my network. But we've had 15 specialties last year, but the plurality is always ophthalmologists because that's my network. But very international. We had five continents in the program last year. People came from all over the world for it. And it's a very exciting. I said there's three co-equally valuable, and I mean that co-equally valuable parts of the program. The academics, very valuable. What you're learning is very valuable. Who you meet is equally as valuable. So these networks that form through the class become lifelong. And the 2015 class still has an active WhatsApp group that talks to each other every week. I mean,
that's neat.
So it, and I call it their personal board of directors. You know, they go, I've got this idea. What do you think? They get feedback. Hey, you should introduce you to so-and-so. Did you know about this? I tried it in the past, whatever. Great conversations. And then the third part, of course, is just taking yourself out of your own way, getting out of your own practice situation, your own daily life with work and family and everything else, and isolating yourself into this really stimulating environment to look at your life from a distance and say, where am I going next? Because we want everyone to leave with their business plan, and that business plan really is your life plan. So where are you going next? And I don't know that many people ever do that. And to do it four times in 1 year for 5 days at a time and ask that question, where am I going next? We've had people make remarkable transformations and some incredibly successful stories out of it.
Wow, that is amazing. It sounds like I need to do this. Absolutely. I think I'm at a point now where I've got a lot of fun projects going on, and this would be a neat little adventure for me. I think I'd learn a lot.
That's great. Well, love to have you. Love to have you. So, you know, my whole focus is trying to, you know, I've had three parts to my career. You asked me about, talk about my career. First 10 years I practiced. The next, you know, 20 years I tried to work on what I call facilitation. All these FDA studies and nomogram development, working with as a consultant to the CEOs on tech strategies and forming medical advisory boards, you know, kind of facilitating, getting things to happen. But this third phase of my career for the last, you know, 13 or 14 years has been what I call system design. Looking at the system and saying, how do we do this better? How do we do it in a bigger scale? Are we focusing on tactics, or are we focusing on purpose? Are our tactics addressing our purpose? Or do we get so caught up? And I love to think about Elon Musk when he had Tesla and he was developing the Hyperloop. And they said, well, if your Hyperloop is successful, people will buy fewer Teslas. And he said, well, I don't care. He said, because my goal is not to, you know, he said the auto industry started out making autos and they got better and better autos. And they start to pay attention to brakes and tires and steering mechanisms and suspensions and all those things, which make the cars safer and better. And their focus became the cars. But the purpose was to move people.
Right.
It was to move people safely. And the Hyperloop can do that better. Well, we have to focus on what is our purpose. Are we here to do a perfect whatever, or to treat people who, you know, already have access to other vision care? Are we here to compete with the guy down the street or the gal down the street? Or are we here to solve the vision needs of humanity? There's so few ophthalmologists in the world. And there's so many people in the world. We are so not up to the task with the systems that we have today. We have got to do better to scale. It takes a long time to train an ophthalmologist. We can't just you know, produce another, you know, triple the number of ophthalmologists overnight. And we don't need to. We can take the ophthalmologists right now with better system design, using things like digital health, using things like ancillary personnel, using things like standards, and allow us to scale till we can actually reach the needs of all humanity. So system design for me is my focus. And it's you know, it's hard because you're telling people to change, and change is hard. But usually through conversations like this and all the talks we give and all the articles we write and all the people that we influence one at a time, it's making a difference, and we can see it happen.
Amazing. Well, I want to thank you. I'm going to put some links below for our viewers and our listeners to check out. You have so many projects. We're going to have a link for the World College of Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences, the Refractive Surgery Alliance, DataLink, Physician CEO. Guy, you work hard, my friend. You do so many projects at once. It's amazing.
Well, thanks, Uday. You're very kind. I, you know, for me, it's not work. It's
just fun. Yeah.
It's just joy. It's what I'm here for. And anyone who wants to contact me personally, will also put my email on those links. Always feel free to do that. I would love to talk to you. I always want to meet new people who are like-minded and want to change the world and make it better. So love to have you contact me and support whatever you're working on.
Thank you again, Guy.
Thank you, Uday. And keep up the great work at Cataract Coach. It's so important.